CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 86, with Ramesh Ayala, professor and chairman, University of South Florida in Tampa. Critical life lessons and bringing the best care to all patients.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And then I have a very special guest and a very dear friend, professor and chairman, Dr. Ramesh Ayala. Ramesh, welcome to our podcast.
Oh, Uday, I've been looking forward to this. Thank you for the invitation.
So tell us about, you had an incredible academic journey in ophthalmology. You're a glaucoma specialist, you're a cornea specialist. You make the most complex cases look easy.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. It's not easy, actually. It's very time consuming and it's been a passion. When I was back in medical school in India, we had a surgeon, a terrific surgeon. Anterior segment surgery was just beginning at that time, and I saw him do some complex cases, and I thought to myself, someday I want to be that guy. Yeah. And that journey, after all of these years, circled back to me being what I'm doing right now, you know?
Yeah, it takes years to learn, but truly a lifetime to master.
Yeah, that is so true. That is so true. And one thing I was reflecting as you asked this question, what you think of when you're young, you want to be that, and you start the journey, eventually you will reach it. And that journey is what you should enjoy. I don't know what the results are going to be like, but the journey has been tremendous for me.
Yeah, the process. Take us through your journey. What was your journey in ophthalmology? How did you get started, and how did you decide you like it, and what brought you to train it? You trained in Boston. And then you also had a big academic career. Tell me everything. So why aren't you a cardiologist? Relatives always say to me, my relatives tell me, oh, how can we do ophthalmology? You couldn't get into cardiology? They'll tell me.
So when I was in medical school back in India, in Hyderabad, India, at Gandhi Medical College is where I attended my medical school in 1983-84. As a final year medical student, I was exposed to general surgery. Ophthalmology was a subspecialty. We did rotate through ophthalmology as part of medical school, but it's not as well developed or well recognized as it is today. Back in the early days of 1980s, everybody talked about, if you want to do surgery, you have to be a general surgeon. Mm. And I wanted to be a general surgeon initially. Okay, so as fate would have it, the selection process for being a general surgeon postgraduate student was to take an entrance exam, and I stood 70th rank or something in that pack. And all the general surgery seats were taken up by people who scored in the top 20. Mm. So ophthalmology was an afterthought. And I'm so glad.
Right.
It let me into ophthalmology that way. And after that, I did a whole bunch of eye camps, and I was inspired about what we did during the eye camps. I did almost 25 eye camps over a period of 2 years in India. And one thing that about life money cannot buy is the joy that you see in those patients who are blind with light cataracts, and you take those out and you put those AFK glasses in front of them, and they're like, wow, I can see your face. And believe it or not, even today, In Central Florida, we have white cataracts in nursing home patients, and they exhibit the same emotions.
Yeah.
It's something that every one of us have to experience.
The magic of the white cataract. Same with me. When I was in medical school, I didn't plan on doing ophthalmology, and I happened to see a cataract surgery, but white cataract. And I saw the patient walking in blind, holding the wall. And then the next day, after an elegant surgery, vision restored. I thought it was like the most amazing miracle in all of that.
Right. And so after I decided I'm going to do ophthalmology, I took a one-way ticket. Back then, they would allow you to fly into England with one-way ticket.
Whoa.
So 200 pounds in my pocket, one-way ticket to London. I landed in November of that year. First time ever leaving my city that I grew up in. Into the winter of London, I took my lab exam, as they call it, which is the qualifying exam there, similar to the USMLE now. And I spent that winter, that Christmas, with a friend of mine, and then got into residency program in what is now called Liverpool Mercy Regional Hospital Systems. So Liverpool, Chester, Warrington, that's the circuit that I did my residency training in. And towards the end of it, I got bored. I did so many surgeries. And suddenly one day when I was introduced to trabeculectomy operations, the thought came to me that no one knows what is the thickness, ideal thickness for the trap flap would be.
Right.
Right? One asked the question, and the surgeons I found there were all flustered with sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. So I did my first self-initiated research experiment in my bedroom.
How'd you do it in your bedroom?
So I called around. I wanted to get a hold of sclera. So I called the local eye bank and then said, hey, I called them and said, tell me if I can go and harvest an eyeball. Next time you get a donor called, you call me. And then sure enough, they called me and said, in such and such a nursing home, somebody died and they're willing to donate their eyeballs. So I drove to the nursing home and I spoke to the family and said, hey, I plan to do research with these eyeballs. Is that okay with you? They said, sure. So I harvested the two eyeballs myself and I took it back. And then what I did was to use a trephine, 8mm trephine, and then trephinated all the sclera around the limbus. Now I cut the sclera into various thicknesses, right? Uh-huh. But the sclera, the limbus was typically 0.72 millimeters thick. So when we create the scleral flap for the trabeculectomy, remember, you can end up with thin sclera, thin scleral flap, like 0.2 right. millimeters, 0.3 millimeters. So I designed 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, and 0.6 millimeter thickness scleral flaps. And then I went to the bioengineering lab and then I asked them to build me a little gadget where I can suspend the sclera in the middle, screw it in, and on one side is a water column that is high pressure chamber, and the other side is the low pressure chamber. And I stuck the entire thing in my bedroom, and I injected fluorescein. I forgot what dye I injected, but I injected a dye into the high pressure chamber. And the idea is, over a period of time, I would measure the amount of fluid, the fluorescein or the dye that would come into the low pressure chamber.
Okay.
Guess what happened? So that was the one bedroom apartment in Liverpool. I stuck it in the bedroom window and I would wait and wait and wait. Nothing came into the low pressure chamber. And then I took out and under the microscope, I could see that the scleral fibers, the dye particles were all stuck and trapped within the scleral fibers.
Oh.
So the next brilliant idea that I had was to use a labeled sodium technetium.
Okay.
So I went to the nuclear medicine lab and the guy, and I proposed this idea of them giving me this nuclear labeled particles and stick it into the high pressure chamber. He got so excited. Poor guys. Never seen an eye experiment like this. And so we stuck this thing in front of the gigameter, and lo and behold, with various thickness of scleral flaps, we had different rates of flow of fluid, and we were able to actually tabulate that. And that was my first presentation in an international meeting. I sent it to Orwell and it was accepted. I remember packed people. The poster was so well attended. There were so many people listening to the talk. And from behind everyone else, a voice towards the very end said, I love this for this presentation. I would like to publish this in my journal. Send it to me. Wow. So I'm like, who are you and what journal editor are you? So the guy goes, I am George Spade.
Oh, George Spade. Wow.
And I am the editor-in-chief of ophthalmology, surgery, and lasers, or something like that. So I called back, after the meeting, I called my senior registrar, Colm O'Brien. He's still in practice in Dublin, Ireland. And said, hey, Colm, this guy called George Speth wants to publish this. He says, you spoke to George Speth? I said, well, he was in front of me. He wants to publish it. I asked him what his name is. He said, did you say that really? I said, yeah. And that's how my journey into research started. And then I found that at that time, back then, they did not have fellowships in England.
Okay.
But Carl O'Brien, the same guy that I spoke about, he just came back from Boston during my final year in St. Paul's in Liverpool. And, by our glaucoma guy, Peter Wishart, everybody was scared of him. Dr. Wishart was a super nice guy, but he had his tempers, right? And so, but in our grand rounds, at the end of the conversation, everybody would turn to Carl and say, what did they do in Boston? And Carl O'Brien would say X, Y, and Z, and that was it. People would accept whatever he said. I'm like, at that Christmas, I asked Carl, I want to go to Boston. I want to do a fellowship there because it looks like that's the mecca of glaucoma. Sure. So Carl started laughing at me, and his wife came in and said, why are you laughing at Ramesh? He thinks he can go and practice ophthalmology, learn glaucoma in Boston. So I said, Carl, just give me a contact. Let me figure this one out. So he sent me up with Joe Gunnar with Dr. Capriol. So Dr. Capriol was in Yale Medical School at that time. So he offered a research fellowship. So we landed in Danbury, Connecticut. And my wife took my internal medicine spot in Danbury, Connecticut. Okay. Both of us, I did my FRCS by this time in England, and she did her MRCP in internal medicine. And so we had a one-year-old daughter, $1,000, and two suitcases. We landed in New York City, and from there went to Danbury, Connecticut. And one fine Monday morning, I don't remember how I accessed to Yale, Connecticut, but I ended up in Yale, and it was a sunny Monday morning. And Joe Caprioli took me to this Chinese fast food joint, right? And he fed me lunch, and he said, good news, bad news, Ramesh. I'm like, what is that about? So Dr. Caprioli said, well, the good news is you can do your research fellowship with me. The bad news is I lost funding, so I can't pay you.
Oh, my goodness.
So I said, Dr. Caprioli, I appreciate the offer, but we can't survive this way. We have a one-year-old daughter in the house of and so I went back home to Danbury, and then I knocked on the internal medicine chair. By this time, my wife, DP, started internal medicine residency as a second year resident. And so I knocked on Paul Iannini was his name, Dr. Iannini, ID guy. And I knocked on his door, and he said, who are you? I go, I'm DP's husband. And so he said, what can I do for you? I said, Dr. Iannini, good news and bad news. So he goes, what the hell that does mean? So I said, well, this is the reason why I came, and the fellowship fell through. So that's the bad news. The good news is I found out that if I do internship in with you, and then I can take the licensing exam, I can now apply for a clinical fellowship, not just a research fellowship.
Right.
Those were the rules back then. He looked at me in 30 seconds. He called his secretary and created a spot for me.
Oh, wow.
This is post-match. And so I lucked out. I did my internship year with him. And in 6 months, I applied for clinical fellowships and a match in Mass Eye and Ear. And all doors opened up after, I met some really great people in Mass Eye and Ear. They're my mentors there. And from the research angle point of view, I have to say, I tell you, that's my dream come true place. I got exposed to such fabulous people doing such fabulous work in all aspects of medicine, but especially in ophthalmology and glaucoma. And, I never looked back after that.
Wow, amazing. No, I got to backtrack for a second. So what is the perfect flap thickness for a trabeculectomy?
Less than 0.5 millimeters.
So we should probably use a diamond blade to get the correct depth then before making it.
Right. So if you want to, remember, this was the pre-mitomycin era when I did these experiments. So after 0.5 millimeters, there's no flow.
Mm.
So you should aim, if you're not using mitomycin, you should aim for 0.3 millimeters or so. That's what I aim for. Okay. If it's too thin, then when you tie the suture of the flap, close the flap, you're going to create holes in it, and there's too much outflow, and then you end up with shallow chambers and all the consequences of that. So somewhere in the range of 0.3 to 0.35 is ideal. If you aim for 0.5, because we're using mitomycin now, I always lift the flap, put mitomycin underneath the flap.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And around it and subconjunctival like everybody else do. But I also rub that sponge underneath this little flap too. And I use mitomycin only for like 45 seconds. And my results are as good, if not better, compared to those people who use mitomycin for 2 minutes, 3 minutes. But one thing I have to say, I don't see avascular cystic blebs with the technique that I use.
Great. That's important.
It is an important point for people to remember.
Yeah, maybe we could feature a video of that of you. We've had many of your videos in the past on CounterCoach. I'm a big fan, obviously.
Now, I'm actually recording. You are a stickler to quality control. So I'm making sure that the videos that we have, surgeries that we're doing, they're all in high def. And very soon, we will send you all the basics of glaucoma surgery, straps, tubes, and everything else. ECPs, and everything else that we do.
Fantastic. So after you did this glaucoma fellowship at Harvard, you also stayed in Boston for another year to do a cornea fellowship.
Yes, I stayed in Boston University. Long story short, I had a year in between. And what happened was that research year, I mean, it was a clinical fellowship, but I was more attracted towards what I learned in terms of research. And if you want to pursue cutting edge research, this is the country. I mean, you just cannot, even in England, there was no basic science research going on at that time. I don't know what the situation is today, but in 1990s, when I was there, there was clinical research, yes, but nothing that was too exciting. So I decided if I'm going to become a clinician scientist, this is the country that I need to stay back in. Now, Tom Hutchison, who was one of my mentors, he was the president of the academy the year prior to my being the fellow there. He told me, hey, Ramesh, you need to repeat. Why do you need to struggle? If I can get you a job to be a faculty in a place, but you will be always at the mercy of a chair.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you, because in India, when I started my medical school, I was 17 years old. So I was, by American standards, I was still on the younger side. Yeah. So he said, you know, I would suggest that you apply for a residency program, get yourself fully accredited by the American Academy, and that way no one can ever touch you. That was his advice. So I did apply and matched in Tampa, in USF, but I had a year to kill, and I always was had interest in the cornea. And so I did a year of cornea in Boston and then came down to Tampa.
Wow. Well, it proves useful for you. So we had a video of yours recently on Cataract Coach where the very complicated cases, Boston K-Pro, plus you do the glaucoma procedure. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. So because of that background, plus in Tulane, when I became faculty in Tulane, Del Caldwell, our chair, Del passed away recently, 6 months ago, and you've been there when Del Caldwell was visiting Tampa, right? So Del is an amazing, or was an amazing gentleman and a brilliant surgeon. Del's opening statement to me when I joined his Tulane faculty is, I asked him, can I do anything and everything? He said, listen, you're double fellowship trained. I will not stop you from doing anything anterior segment. As long as nothing bad comes back to me, you are allowed to do anything, is what he told me. And true to his word, even though some of the cornea faculty initially had doubts as to why I'm doing this and that and everything else, they'll always back me. And so I've always done anterior segment, mostly glaucoma, but a lot of cornea too along the way. And you know, it always surprises me when people say, I'm going to do pure glaucoma. I think they're missing the point that 50% of all glaucomas end up with cornea problems.
Sure.
And 50% of all corneas end up with glaucoma problems.
Sure.
And unless you understand the basics of both aspects of it, you cannot solve these problems. And that's why those videos that you're kindly presenting to the world to watch, it shows what amazing work can be done, both controlling glaucoma and doing cornea work. In that case, using the KPRO appropriately, we restored the vision to 2030. You know, it's a life-changing event for that particular patient. So that kind of a can-do attitude will come when you tackle both cornea and glaucoma and, of course, cataracts in the mix.
Everything together, yeah.
Everything together. One stop.
You're right. So you obviously had great experience there as faculty at Tulane. And then you actually return now to become chairman at USF Tampa, University of South Florida.
You know, what can I tell you? Life has been busy with what I call as nation building. Yeah. You know, when I was a young faculty as assistant professor in Tulane, 3 years into it, one day Dell called me into his office and said, "Hey, a program has been put on probation. I need your help. What can I do for you?" So he said, "I want you to be the program director." So okay. I said, "Okay." I looked back then, this is in 2003, 2004. There used to be what is called as a green book, a guide from ACGME as to how to run the program. So for ophthalmology, I opened it, I looked at it, and I said, this is easy. I'll fix this program in 1 year. Okay. This is a true story. So within 6 months, I fixed the program. All the citations that we had in Tulane residency at that time. I fixed the program, and by March of that year, I contacted ACGME. Our site visit was scheduled. This is in 2005. March of 2005, I called ACGME, and our site visit was scheduled for December. I really wanted to get our program off the probationary list.
Sure.
You know? So I called them and said, "Hey, can you prepone this site visit?" And the guy laughed at me and he said, "You know, no one calls us ever to say come early. We always get calls to say come late." And I said, "You're dealing with a different animal here. I am ready for you." So September 3rd was our site visit schedule.
Okay.
2005. And as you know, August 30th, Katrina came. Right. And New Orleans subsequently was underwater. And I remember on September 1st, 2nd, I was in Dallas at that time because we could not come back home. And I got a call from this guy. And he said, are you ready with all the paperwork?" I'm like, "This is the site visitor from ACGME." I nearly fell off the chair. I said, "What planet are you living in? You know, the city is underwater. The medical school is underwater. And I am here in Dallas. I don't think there will be a site visit unless you want me to be on the phone and we can talk about this, right?" So our site visit has been postponed, obviously. And it's been a journey. One of the toughest things that we did was to go through Katrina, where the city lost everything. We lost everything. And it was, but day five, I decided, a lot of my residents started calling me and saying, what is in store for us? And, you know, at that point in time, I thought to myself, you know, I can pack my bags and practice medicine, ophthalmology in three continents. I was certified. Board certified in England, board certified in America, board certified in India. I can literally go anywhere on planet Earth and practice ophthalmology. But my students, residents who had such trust in me, you know, if I leave them high and dry, at that point in time, till then, I don't think mainland United States has ever experienced anything like Katrina. Nobody knew. There was no blueprint as to what needs to be done. So I decided, I remember telling my wife, "We're going to stay back. I'm going to rebuild Tulane and take care of these residents." And I wrote a letter at that time to ACGME, AUPO, ABO, and the AUPR. All the national organizations, I wrote a letter saying that, "Hey, I'm the program director from Tulane. I don't know what to do with my residents. Is there a possibility that I can place my residents in your programs?" And I have to tell you, every single program in this country responded. And they all offered to help out. So we took majority of the residents to Baylor that graciously opened their doors. But some of our residents went to California, wherever their home base was, and we allowed them to go. But the problem was the senior residents. 30-year residents, because no one wanted to share the surgical wealth.
Right.
So we in Tulane, we had the three VA hospitals under our care. One of them happened to be in northern Louisiana, in Alexandria. So I called the chief of staff in VA hospital in Northern Louisiana, Alexandria, and I introduced myself and I said, hey, I'm so-and-so, here's a problem. I need to train my 30 years, and your hospital is the only one that I know of under our care that is not affected. Would you give us access? He goes, he said, what do you want? I said, we need accommodation. A lot of our residents lost their homes. We need accommodation.
Yeah.
So to his credit, they opened, emptied up a building and all like old fashioned Gurkul style. You know, we all moved into this apartment block.
Wow, that's fun.
My family in one apartment and all the residents and their families were living in the other apartments, and I redid the VA rotations that they're still following and increased their surgical volumes and increased the number of patients that we were allowed to see in the VA clinics. And they gave me a free hand in redesigning that rotation there. And our residents who went through that rotation and graduated, they all did great, you know, and they're practicing successfully in various parts of the country. And then 6 months later, obviously, we came back to Tulane, and we started Tulane practice again in a smaller center. And a year later, we went back to main campus. But along the way, I learned a lot about dealing with stress. And I did, you know, it's funny. I was telling this story to one of our, when recently the hurricane came to Tampa and people are all panicking. I was telling the story in the immediate aftermath of Katrina. I was one of the few ophthalmology surgeons in New Orleans.
They all left.
Yeah, boy, they all left. So we were given access to a small surgical center closer to the airport. And LSU was not in sight, and I remember a lot of patients coming in with eye emergencies, and I was operating on them almost every single day. And almost a few months later, I asked my surgical tech if they're keeping tab, because there were no computers working.
Okay.
So I asked them, are you keeping track of their names and their medical record numbers and stuff like that? They said, no one told me to.
Oh my goodness.
Believe it or not, the first 3 or 4, 6 months, I did so many surgeries, and we don't know who we operated on. Anybody who would come in with an eye emergency, we would take care of them. We would follow them till they get better, and they would disappear into wherever they came from. But, you know, and then slowly we rebuilt Tulane. And along the way, and I stayed. I gave my word to Del Caldwell that I will stay till as long as it takes for me to rebuild Tulane, and I kept my word. And along the way, I wanted to do something back in India, and so I built Ananda Institute there 13 years ago. And now, 6 years ago, they called me to USF, and I've done the same thing for USF too. We rebuilt this program in USF now. It's doing very well. I mean, I'm kind of proud of this, what I call as nation building. Across two continents.
Yes. For there at USF, you built a brand new eye institute, basically, over the last few years.
Yeah.
I mean, plus, I like that you just have a knack for the big, bad trauma cases.
Yes.
So now you've got TGH, Tampa General Hospital, which is incredible. I have a video coming up, actually. It's going to be the day after this podcast, of a knife in the eye that you sent me. I could not believe that's the video we're going to show tomorrow, the day after this podcast airs. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's amazing. We get, you know, in this day and age of refractive cataract surgeries and mixed procedures, people forget that almost 70% of eye problems, they don't fit into that category.
Right.
And what I worry about personally is if all the young surgeons are attracted only to that aspect of ophthalmology as to what is going to happen to the really sick people with sick eyes.
Right.
And it's already playing out in Central Florida, probably the rest of the country and the rest of the world. The video that you played out on acute glaucoma with a flat chamber, which the pressure is 60 for one whole month. That lady went through 4 emergency rooms and 2-3 ophthalmologists in various parts of Central Florida before she ended up coming to Tampa Emergency Room, and I took care of her. And this, I see this on a daily basis.
Right. So for those who don't remember, that was a case of chronic angle closure. She had a high pressure for a long time, total white cataract. In fact, the whole iris was shoved into the angle. You couldn't even see the iris. You
couldn't see the iris.
And you reconstructed the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, so I think at one level, it is great that our young ophthalmologists are able to do refractive cataract surgery and mixed procedures. On the other hand, I think we should not forget that we as physicians should take care of all comers.
Right.
We just cannot say, hey, I don't do this and shove them into the nearest emergency room. Because in this complex healthcare environment, which is a jungle, especially here in Florida, it is so difficult to navigate. These poor people, they don't know where to go. And the other thing that I see here in Florida, same thing that I experienced many years ago, almost 40 years ago in rural India, with eye camps, the nursing homes here in Florida, full of white cataracts.
Wow.
Why? Because there's no money in taking care of these sick people and taking those white cataracts. So they all come to us and we take them to Tampa Hospital, and they're so overjoyed when their vision is restored. You know, at some level, I think our young trainees should open their eyes to other aspects of ophthalmology and not be carried away only with the quote-unquote sexy cataract surgeries.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You also get referred to a lot of complex cases. I remember once I talked about a choroidal hemorrhage, and I've never in 25 years experienced one. And then you sent me a video. You sent me a video with a dozen different cases of it and how to manage it, how to drain it. I was like, wow, I've never seen this ever.
But welcome to my world. I mean, I drain at least 3 or 4 suprachoroidal hemorrhages every year. I've been doing that for the last 25 years now. You know,
I'm happy to show keep those videos on Cataract Coach. So now we have a library. You know, God forbid I ever end up having one of those. Now at least I know how to manage it. I can go to Cataract Coach, watch that video again. And yeah, you have a tremendous number of these cases, very, very complex cases. So
these are all sick eyes, and it comes in the territory. You know, I mean, when you open an eye with pressures of 60, suprachoroidal hemorrhage is part and parcel of it. And when it happens, the best time, and I think I said this before to you, the only chance that you have to drain the suprachoroidal hemorrhage is if it happens on the table. Drain it immediately. Right. Do the sclerotomy immediately, and some blood will come out. But whatever blood comes out, it's going to minimize the extent of the suprachoroidal hemorrhage and also controls the pain to some degree. Within 30, 40 minutes, the blood is clotted. And after that, you have to wait for 7 to 10 days and then go back in and drain it out at a later date.
Yeah, but complex cases there. But yeah, so the nice part, though, is for your residents and fellows who train with you, what an incredible surgical experience they have then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of proud of all the residents that we trained in Tulane. Almost 300 of them went through our program during my tenure there. And the current fellow is my 27th glaucoma anterior segment fellow.
Wow.
And you had Annalisa on your podcast.
Yes, yeah. Dr. Arosa Mena. What a fantastic podcast.
Annalisa is one of a kind. What can I tell you?
Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So you built up now the new Eye Institute there at USF. You're really putting it on the map. It's climbing every year in the rankings. It's getting the name is strong. But you're also getting referred in a lot of these outside places. You're saying a lot of Central Florida cases. You're on the west coast of Florida, but these are coming from Central Florida driving in.
When I was at Tulane, I used to get referred patients from Texas all the way to Florida Panhandle.
Oh, wow.
And so a lot of my patients from Louisiana and Mississippi that have access and money and whatever, they still come see me in Tampa. Now in the last 3 years, after the COVID, especially, we are seeing patients from all over Florida, from Miami all the way to Tallahassee. So it's whoever comes, my doors are always open. I never say no to a patient. I'm kind of old fashioned. If a patient is willing to drive 6 hours to see me, I am like, I will wait for an hour extra and see, take care of that patient. And that's, it's been my philosophy all my life, and I'm not going to change at this stage.
Oh, that's the best. Now, also, you mentioned briefly about your eye institute you started there in Hyderabad, the Anand Eye Institute. Tell me about this project and what motivated you to start an eye institute there?
This is in the aftermath of Katrina. And as we went through all the stress and strains of going through Katrina, at some point, even before that, I had this idea, but it kind of motivated me to do something similar to my hometown that I grew up in Hyderabad, India. So I went back and forth, and finally found a soulmate in Satish Agraharam. You met Satish.
Yes, I visited. Beautiful.
Yeah. And so put together, and a dear friend of ours, who is the CEO of VivaMed, Santosh, he laid out the business aspect of it. And because we tried to interview a lot of candidates, and everybody who would come in were all like, how much money am I going to make in this institute? And my goal was different. You know, yes, you're going to make lots of money, but I want that institute to be a training ground for the future ophthalmologists, and also have some charity component to it where we'll do eye cams and all the poor patients will do it for free. So a foundation is attached to it, and bring in quality care for the middle class in India. That was the whole concept. It's not to serve the rich and the famous.
Yeah, of course.
So finally, after going through, I went back and forth for almost 3 years before I met Satish. As fate would have it, Santosh introduced me to Satish, and the rest was history, like they say. And last year, we celebrated 13th year.
Oh.
And you were kind enough to be our chief guest last year, remember, on Zoom. And one of these days, I got to take you back to see all the progress that we made.
So I would love to.
The institute, you know, now we have a residency program. We have a fellowship program in cornea, glaucoma, and retina. We have a school of optometry, a full faculty in every subspecialty in ophthalmology. And after LVP, LV Prasad, I think ours is the largest eye institute of its kind teaching center in that state, that part of the world. So I'm very proud of what we did there. And we have done lots of eye camps. Because of COVID, we stopped it. But more recently, we started it again. A lot of eye camps and free surgeries for patients coming out of the eye camps. So it's been a fulfilling ride.
Yeah. So what's interesting is in the U.S., there's ACGME.
Right.
And so American College of Graduate Medical Education. So the training for all residency programs kind of standardized. But in other countries, whether it's in India or in Europe, that's not always the case. And so what's neat about your program is you bring in a very regimented, almost USA style of training to the Anand Eye Institute.
So there is actually an organization in India that governs all of the training programs.
Okay.
They do come and inspect the training hospitals. And yes, you're right that the variation of the theme is much more in countries like India. But they do have a structure. But the thing is, being such a large country and so many programs, the rules are not implemented as strictly as they are done in the United States. So what I did was to take what we do here and try to transpose what is practical out there. And the outcome is what you see there. And LV Prasad did the same thing too.
I mean, sure.
You have some fantastic training programs in India, LV Prasad, Arvind System, Shankar Netralaya, to mention a few. And so we mimicked, I actually interviewed Arvind faculty members, the founders, to take some lessons from them to put that into our Ananda Institute DNA.
Oh, that's amazing. Amazing progress. So now on your journey, because you've had an incredible ophthalmology journey, like you said, spanning three continents, all over the place. What's next in your big journey? You start now at USF, you've kind of redesigned, built this new eye institute. What's coming next in your journey?
So, well, if I fail, don't laugh at me. All along, you know, in year 2000, I wanted to remember, I told you my first inclination to come to the United States was because of my interest in research.
Sure.
I always took a backstage because fate, whatever you want to call it, drove me into building these centers. I mean, Katrina came, forced me to spend 7 years of my life. I didn't do anything other than work 24/7 for Tulane. I mean, the amount of work I put into Tulane ophthalmology was you had to only imagine. I mean, it was incredible the amount of energy that I put into that, and at the exclusion of everything else. Same thing is happening in USF the first 4 years, 5 years of it. And in Ananda Institute, when we did that, I gave 100% there too. But along the way, what took a backstage was my research ideas.
Sure.
This part of it, this next few years, you're going to see a whole host of new, hopefully, products coming out of my lab that will change the way we're going to practice medicine, glaucoma especially. So the first one that's going to come out, and I'm going to share this with you, is a app that we created. We're using your smartphone and a $20 vision field VR goggle set. Under $50, you can test your vision fields yourself at home.
Wow.
You know, we are building all these big institutions that are so expensive that you're limiting health care to only the rich and the famous. 94% of glaucoma patients, for example, live outside the United States. They don't have the technology that we have. If you have glaucoma in major part of the rest of the world, more than likely you're going to end up going blind.
Wow.
For lack of simplicity and simple techniques and knowledge. And glaucoma, even in the United States, it's so difficult for patients to access a glaucoma specialist who's completely trained, right? And so my goal for the next 10 years is to simplify healthcare diagnostics and surgical tools, make them cheap enough that anybody anywhere in the world with some knowledge of accessing them can access them. So the first one that's going to come out, we are doing the clinical trials, and I was so fortunate to have your son Arun. Arun was the instigator for the beginning stages of that vision field project, and now we actually have an app. It's
awesome.
There. It's already in the test pilot mode, and we are releasing the 0.2 version of it very soon. Once it's done, I'm going to send it to you and Arun to test pilot it before I go public with it. But it's working beautifully. It's almost 100% as accurate as your Humphrey vision field. The beauty is now I'm able to capture the data and visualize your vision field that you're doing from home. The first of its kind where the patient is testing in the house, and we are able to visualize the vision fields. Now,
very low cost.
Huh?
Very low cost.
Listen. My goal has always been not to make money. You know, in 2003, I was probably the first guy in the world to have built this system. Tulane wanted to patent it, and they found a patent existing from some guy in California who in 1995, 1996 or so had the same vision, even though at that point in time, there was nothing like a VR goggle around, but he had the same concept. And he patented it back before 1998. Do you know that you could patent an idea? After 1998, they shut that down. You cannot patent an idea anymore. You need to have a demo of your idea, a working demo, before you can apply for a patent. And so Tulane lost interest in it, and then Katrina came, and I forgot completely about this project. And you know, a lot of these companies now are doing that, where they're taking the software and embedding it into the VR goggle set, and they're selling it for $30,000. Again, out of reach for a majority of the patient population. So true glaucoma, meaning glaucoma care in the home setting, is still missing. And I want to fill that gap. So the first in that direction is the VR goggle app and the smartphone app. The patient downloads the app into their smartphone, puts it to the VR goggle set, does the testing. And eventually I'm going to apply AI, so the test results will tell the patient directly whether it's good, bad, or ugly, and when they can, they need to go see the doctor. That's number one. Two, we're working on a sensor.
A sensor, okay.
A microsensor, a 1.75 millimeter chip.
Okay.
That you can suture to the iris. And using your smartphone, you can read off the pressure of the eye, continuous intraocular pressure monitoring system.
Wow.
But that's still going to be expensive. What the next idea that I have of this project, I want to create an app similar to the VR goggles app that the patient can use that is so simple that for $10 they can download the app and reasonably check their intraocular pressure. That, I'm working on that aspect of it, but that may be many years away. But if you think about this, you have an app for the VR, the visual fields, an app to check the intraocular pressure. Every patient in the world should be able to afford this, monitor themselves, and go see the doctor when things are getting worse.
Right?
That's the beauty of this. Now we are working on a slow release anti-scar tissue medication system.
Okay.
The number one reason why all glaucoma surgeries fail. Do you know why?
Sure, scars up.
Scar, fibrosis. It doesn't matter whether you put a Zen or do a trabeculectomy or put the AMID or Barwell, it makes no difference at all. And even all the mixed procedures, after a certain point, they fail because of fibrosis. So in our lab, we have a wide variety of antifibrotic systems. One is hooked up to a PLGA polymer, a 14 micron wafer that you're going to slip in under the subconjunctival for all the subconjunctival procedures. Mm. And we have HA, hyaluronic acid that is linked to mitomycin and some other antifibrotic agents that you can inject into the Schlemm's canal or subconj if you want to. We have a whole host of drugs now attached to this complex porous hyaluronic acid that we developed. And we see a lot of, for example, fungal infections in Central Florida.
Right.
And that is true in all of the tropical world, especially in India too. I mean, a lot of this farming community, and once fungus tastes your cornea, it's very difficult to eradicate, and using those drops for months on end. So we have a slow-release natamycin system that's working in our lab.
Oh, yeah, for natamycin. Wow. So you can have round-the-clock release.
That's the idea. It is working in the lab. Now, the most interesting thing that we developed at the height of COVID, you know, my wife is a infectious disease specialist, and my daughter at that time was in your alma mater, USC, doing her residency training there. And every night they would be on the phone saying, hey, my patient here had this complication, died, or, you know, in LA, this is what happened. And the Divya at that time complained that they could not have access to the high-end mask, you know. And so at 10 o'clock that night, I asked myself, what is this that we need a mask for? I mean, the rest of the world is not masking. They don't have access to all these high-end masks that we're talking about in the United States. Everybody in the rest of the world, they're all putting on a cotton something around their nose and mouth, right? So I wanted to create a spray that you can spray on the piece of cloth, and that will kill the virus on contact.
Ah, interesting.
And I called my polymer guy, and true enough, within the year, we created what we call as a duty spray now. And interestingly, the spray not only kills COVID virus, but it's killing RSV. We are experimenting to see if it is going to kill herpes, but it's killing every bacteria and fungus it's in contact with. So it's a pan antimicrobial agent that we discovered. And we have several patents on all of these products, so I can freely talk about them through USF. That is going through animal studies right now. So, and the last one, and please don't laugh at me, is the holy grail of all of ophthalmology is total eyeball transplantation.
Cool. How do you do that?
Doing a transplant is not difficult, right? We all know how to enucleate and we know how to put it back.
Okay.
But the key is optic nerve.
And the vasculature.
And the vasculature. So we created a slow-release stem cell device. So where the stem cells are frozen, and they will wake up whenever I want them to. And they start multiplying. I can apply directly to the tissue. So the first rabbit experiment is going to be next week. So wish me luck.
Well, that's amazing.
I don't know what's going to come out of this, but I will try. I will try. And I sincerely hope that at least a couple of these products and ideas that I have in terms of research are going to make it to patients, into the clinic and help our patients worldwide.
I think that's brilliant. You know, a success in an experiment or a project versus a failure, they're actually on the same road, the same journey towards what you need to accomplish. So, like, if I don't mind losing it in an experiment if it doesn't work, because it's still on the same path.
Right. You're right. I mean, to me, this is the most interesting aspect of my life so far. I'm dedicating so much time to my lab. Every minute that I'm away from my clinic, I dream about my research, and my research fellow is 24/7. I'm on his backside, you know. I'll be doing this. But it's been, I cannot complain about my life.
No, it sounds like it's been an amazing journey, but sometimes unpredictable, and you're not sure how it's going to work out, or just have to have some faith and just go with it.
I mean, you know, the worst thing that can happen, like a long time ago that I realized is when I ask people, they can say no, they cannot do anything more than that, right? It's the same thing with the experiment still. It may fail, and if I have the energy, I'll go back at it. And, you know, last weekend I was in San Diego, the American Institute of Chemical Engineers conference, and they wanted me to give a talk on a clinician scientist journey. And the last slide said, translational research, the key for success is perseverance.
Yeah.
You got to persist and persevere. Otherwise, science is never going to move forward. So I am looking forward to this aspect of my journey. What all I did so far for patient care and surgeries and three institutes building up, and all of that is one aspect of it. But translational research, if we can get a couple of products into the marketplace, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, you're right. It requires grit. You have to be tenacious. You have to just keep at it. You cannot give up.
You just have to keep going back to the lab when it fails.
Yeah, and see what you've learned. Okay, it failed, but what did I learn?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Honing in on what you need to do.
Yeah. It's frustrating. I mean, it is frustrating. I mean, but having said that, you give up, it's your baby that you've been working on for so long, and it's going to die with you. On the other hand, you persist and persevere, results are going to be good. I mean, it may not be perfect, but it will jumpstart the research in that direction. So somebody else will pick up from there and maybe perfect it. That's the way to look at life.
Right. You'll continue. The idea that you started may not be the perfect one just yet, but it'll live on in perpetuity even long after you're gone.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's all about legacy now.
this is better than a legacy, because then neat part two is these ideas, these projects, they end up helping so many patients. Okay.
That's what I'm looking forward to. It's like taking the white cataract out. You know, one time I remember there was a young lady, African-American young lady in New Orleans, who had VKH syndrome.
Okay.
And she was blind in one eye, and her only eye, she had massive uveitis with fibrinoid reaction in the anterior chamber and coronal effusions and super high pressures. The angle was completely shut down. And the retina people sent the patient to me. I remember working on her multiple surgeries later. Eventually, I cleared up everything, controlled the pressure, got the retina flat, and took the cataract out. The next day, she came in. And during this entire year of seeing her, her two-year-old daughter or something, she used to be a very active young woman, young lady, the infant. She used to run around the clinic all over the place, right? So After a cataract surgery came, this lady came in and she started crying. I said, what happened now? And she goes, you know, for the first time since I gave birth to my daughter, I saw her face.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. I mean, those kind of moments will stick with you for the rest of your life. And I am very, and any of these products can help out people to get the same kind of feeling, that would be awesome. That would be a life well spent.
So, okay, let's summarize our call with the important things to teach the young ophthalmologists. Because, you know, our podcast is especially listened to by the younger ophthalmologists, 30s and 40s. So, number one, for any research you do, you have to just have grit, persevere, keep working, never give up, be tenacious.
That is correct.
All right, number two, you never know where life will take you. Just be passionate, go with it, and you'll make the most of it.
And make the most of it. Yeah, don't give up. Don't run away. And yeah. Any hurdles that you face, like Katrina, just be there, and you will learn a lot. I'm a better person today, having faced Katrina and stayed back into me.
Right. Yeah. There's something we learn in all challenges, all problems. There's a silver lining. There's a learning.
There is a silver lining. And there is always a learning curve from any problem that you face. Just like in cataract surgery, you know, you are the world's expert, and I learned so much from you. I mean, your talks, your presentations, and the way you carry yourself. I mean, you guys are fabulous examples of how somebody should build their careers. And you know, and you are helping so many people worldwide today. I mean, with your teaching ability. And you're taking this YouTube concept to the masses, so to say. I mean, equalized education. I mean, I don't know if you look at your life like this, what you did with your channel is to democratize cataract surgery across the world. Yeah. Now, any person anywhere, it doesn't matter which part of the world they're living in, they can learn cataract surgery just by watching your channel.
Right, on their mobile phone, anywhere on the planet.
And so I, you know, when I see somebody like you, I'm like, what is wrong with me? I should be watching harder.
That's what I think of you. Believe me, I think, gosh, I'm not as smart as Ramesh. I'm not as hardworking. I'm not as brilliant. I'm not as innovative. But and I think another third lesson for the young surgeons is really embracing the full spectrum of ophthalmology. Including our patients who come in with these very difficult cases, maybe don't have good access to healthcare. Maybe life isn't only about achieving perfect Plano with a premium lens in a refractive cataract patient. Maybe there's more to life than that.
There is more. There is always more to life. And don't ever forget your roots. You know, a lot of us came from nowhere. I mean, with nothing to begin with. And still we are successful. And always think about those days. That's the way I look at life. Always think about where you came from. And don't ever forget people below the, you know, bottom line, people that don't have too much money. I mean, it's not all about rich and famous. Think about the people in nursing homes. And when, you know, we used to do a lot of charity work, and a lot of my residents used to ask me, take me to India, take me to Mexico or wherever. Always used to say, hey, look out of our window. We have poverty here in the United States.
Yes, for sure.
Why don't you take care of people in your own neighborhood first and foremost?
Right. That's a great point. There's no shortage of patients here with white cataracts and who need your help.
Yeah. I mean, it's become fashionable now to go to some other country and then post it immediately on Instagram or whatever. But the reality is there's so many problems in our own country that we live in. And why don't you help out our own community? And that's always my point to everyone. Start at home, be humble, and do the best that you can for the society at large. And I think everything else will take care of itself.
Oh, that is great advice. Great advice. And finally, the last, number four, keep learning. What you learn in your residency and your fellowship is a great start, but it's not the way you're going to do things in 10 or 20 years. You've got to keep up with everything.
You know, I'm 62 years old now. Even today, I watch your videos, And every time you come to Tampa, kind enough to come and give your presentations, I watch you, I see the presentations. You never know when that moment that you showed this thing or that technique will come in handy for saving the eye of a patient.
Right.
Always, always be a learner, lifelong learner.
I think we're both committed to that. Like with Cataract Coach, I learn way more than I teach. You know, I get submitted to me, 30 to 50 videos are sent to me every week. And I watch all of them.
Yeah. See, watching, you pick up those little techniques that help out our own patients when on a difficult day. So I want to thank you for what you're doing. I mean, really, the world is a better place because of people like
you. Oh, you're very sweet. Thank you. Well, I want to thank you, Ramesh. What an incredible podcast. Again, tomorrow's video, if you're listening, this is posted on a Sunday. On the Monday video coming up, it'll be a knife in the eye. The YouTube censors may have a heart attack when they see the video. But what's miraculous is, I mean, obviously a very complex case and required a lot of reconstruction, but achieved reasonable vision.
Yes. That's so that's the other point that I think we should leave with the young audience here. Don't ever give up. There are a lot of techniques that can be used and in reconstructive ophthalmology. And, you know, that case is a perfect case. I mean, you look at it, you say, oh my God,
how is it? It's a nucleate. Yeah.
And then the result is reasonable. I won't say that it's going to be 2020 till the day that we do not know how to regenerate retina. We will have this problem with retina scar limiting the vision. But hey, the lady walked out with an eyeball and still able to see out of that eyeball. So.
Right. Oh, amazing. Amazing. Again, we'll have that video feature tomorrow. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we have a new podcast every single weekend, every Sunday. Top podcast in all of ophthalmology. And, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day. And we'll start featuring more and more videos from Professor Ayala and his team at USF with these very challenging cases so we can all learn together. So until next time, catch you later.